This is Like Mind, Like Body, a podcast about the surprising ways our thoughts and feelings impact our physical health. I'm your host, Laura Sago, and on each episode, I will interview researchers, physicians, and ordinary people who have incredible stories to tell about the power of the mind-body connection. This podcast is brought to you by and a part of Curable. For anyone who is joining us for the first time, a quick overview. At Curable, we create recovery programs for chronic pain. And all of our programs are based on the neuroscience and techniques that you hear us talking about in these podcast episodes. So if you want to get started on applying some of the techniques you hear about here to your own pain, the Curable app is a great place to learn more and get started. You can find more information at curablehealth.com. Today on the show, I am speaking with Dr. Alan Abbas. He is a psychiatrist, professor, and researcher with a particular expertise in educating clinicians on how to effectively and compassionately treat chronic pain. But this interview is not just for clinicians. It provides great information for chronic pain sufferers on how their unconscious emotions can translate into symptoms and some practical advice for what they might be able to do about that. Let's dive into the interview. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Alan. We are delighted to have you here. Someone you have collaborated with recently who our listeners are already familiar with is our friend Dr. Howard Schubner. He's been a guest on the show before. He's also a scientific advisor here at Curable. Can you tell me a little bit more about the Hidden from View book that you co-authored together and what inspired you guys to take on that project?
Well, Howard and I got to know each other over a few years, and I think of Howard, in addition to a friend, is just like a great healer. And we thought we would do a book together that covers the spectrum of ways of understanding symptom formation and ways of diagnosing kind of thing, and also treating. So we put that together in a book.
Yeah. So a lot of our listeners are chronic pain sufferers who may not be quite as familiar with the state of chronic pain treatment and what resources are available to practitioners right now. Many people have the idea that doctors should know everything about all of the most recent research about exactly what treatments can work, what treatments cannot. They expect that doctors should have absolutely all of the answers. So if they come into a world like Dr. Schubner's work or Curable's work or your work, they might start to question, well, if this was true, how come my doctor didn't tell me about it? And they find themselves in this kind of conflict of which authority do I trust? And it can be really confusing for someone who has not gone to medical school, like most of us out there. So what would you say to people who have this concern and who are experiencing this kind of conflict of authorities?
Yeah, well, that's unfortunately too common. There are some physicians who stay up on the current information and they can tell you about these things. And I can tell you, when I presented at the Canadian Internal Medicine Association here a few months ago, and they were extremely interested and asked, you know, Howard and I are writing an article for them, for their journal, because they know it's a deficit. So they eat it up. And I mean, I can just say that there's been a lot of interest in this book for physicians. It was kind of built for physicians and then also for other clinicians too. So they have this kind of information to work with. So it's been there's been a lot of uptake and interest in that information. It's variable, though, as far as how much knowledge a physician will have. But it's tough when there is a conflict, say, between the opinion of your psychologist and your physician, and you're stuck in the middle. But what I would kind of encourage you to do is to realize that ultimately it's you driving the boat, in the sense that you're leading your clinicians. You're like, they're your team. You're the coach in a sense, or at least you're the manager. And that way you have the empowerment to say, okay, I think I need something else. Where can I get more information? And you can tap into some things that are easily or freely available, and other, and direct them to say, look, what do you think about this? And talk to them about it, and then get a certain type of referral or get a certain type of treatment lined up somehow.
I love that way of looking at it, driving your own boat, because I think so many people are fearful of bringing anything back to their physician because they assume that, again, the physician is a superhuman who is able to absorb all information from every research journal every single month, and it has all of the answers. So if they go out and find something like this, a lot of people are afraid to bring it back to their physician, thinking, well, if they haven't told me about it, they're probably going to have a negative reaction to it. And that's actually not what we've seen at all. Most physicians are quite curious about this, and they say, tell me more. I want to learn more. They're interested in, buying your book and educating themselves so that they can help other patients.
Yes, very much so. I mean, physicians say, speaking for a bunch of us, we go into the field for different reasons, but we want to do something positive in the world. The whole helping thing, wanting to help others, kind of a feature. It's common in people who develop somatic symptoms too. Mm-hmm. The wanting to help, wanting to be liked, wanting to, be seen in a good way. This is a common, almost risk factor for developing, certain types of somatic symptoms. Because it's in that kind of setting, it's tough to be aware of and notice and feel emotions, including anger. You see, this is tough. If that person has sort of a fear that it's either going to be harmful or that they're going to be rejected about it, or they're going to hurt someone and then not be liked. And, that sort of becomes something that person gets used to avoiding and bearing those feelings. And that sets the stage for depression and anxiety and somatic symptoms and other problems.
One thing you talk about that I found really interesting is the concept of what you call an anxiety pathway. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah. So anxiety can be conscious anxiety. For example, worried about how it's going to go doing an interview. You could call that a conscious worry, conscious anxiety. Unconscious anxiety is anxiety that affects the body and the person is unaware that it's even present. So it's, and there's specific pathways of unconscious anxiety. So I'll just describe three of the main ones, okay? So the first one is muscle tension that affects muscles that you can move on purpose, or voluntary muscles. And when anxiety is going there, it starts in the thumbs and hands, and it goes down the chest, back to the back, legs, and feet. And at the same time, it can go up to the head, to the jaw, and to the head. The muscles getting tense can show up as spasms or obvious tension, sore muscles, tremors, it can exacerbate or make worse pain symptoms, or can induce pain symptoms when those muscles are all stiff and tight. Mm-hmm. And so that is one pattern. The next pattern affects what's called smooth muscle. That's the muscle of the organs of the body that you don't have any control over. So it affects the airways, the blood vessels, the stomach and bowel, and the bladder. So when those muscles are, they can go to spasm or be overly tense, then the person can have symptoms that include like heartburn or irritable bowel symptoms. They can have blood pressure problems, bladder spasms, migraine headaches can be induced by spasm of the blood vessels that go to the brain. And this is one factor that can induce migraine or can induce all these other symptoms. There's other factors can induce those symptoms too. But one, this unconscious anxiety going in that direction is a main source, a major source of medicine specialty referrals. So like a gastroenterologist, cardiologist, rheumatologist, there are a lot of referrals for smooth muscle anxiety problems.
Mm-hmm. To be clear, these anxiety pathways, do they show up in everyone or just people who end up experiencing forms of chronic pain? What percentage of the population has this anxiety pathway connection that we're talking about here?
It's about a third of people don't have much of any of this going on. The other two thirds of us will have had some childhood adversity and interrupted attachments and have some unprocessed feelings. And that's a risk for having symptoms or having depression or having anxiety or having alcohol problems or other things that stem from or tied to adverse childhood experiences. So it's, unfortunately, it's so common to have childhood trauma. It's the plague of plagues. And I mean, it's a normal. I mean, so let's put it that way. As to which pathways will be affected, how a person will physically be affected. Some people have all these three pathways at times. Other people just have the muscle tension thing. And some people have just mostly that smooth muscle thing, the stomach, and that is the main thing they notice. So it depends on the age of the trauma. The earlier the trauma, the more likely it's going to cause that confusion symptoms and a blurred vision and hearing problems and fainting. So, for example, a person's mother died when she's a year old. They're going to be more likely to land with that type of problem. If a person's father died when they're 7 years old, they're going to have more muscle tension anxiety. And in between, you're going to see a mixture of the different pathways. So the earlier it is, the more likely it goes to confusion. The later it is, the more likely it goes in just muscle tension. Now, muscle tension doesn't mean a person's going to have symptoms necessarily. They may not have any pain, but they're tense. And they might at times get hyperventilation because their chest is tight and they breathe a lot and get a little dizzy from that. Or the shoulders are tense and sometimes they hurt. So it can be without much symptoms, though, that a person has that pattern.
Yeah, there's a quote in your book where you say, healthy emotional experiencing has a specific physiology which is distinct from unconscious right. anxiety. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, exactly. So, well, to talk about, I didn't really cover emotional pathways yet. So anxiety in the body is different than the experience of emotions in the body. So for example, the feeling of, I'm just going to say, a loving feeling, like a feeling, a close feeling, a positive feeling with someone has a nice warmth in the chest. You feel like, you know, a hug or shaking a hand or reaching out to the person. You feel like smiling. You feel a nice warmth. Now, versus the body pathway of anger or rage is also heat, but it moves like from the feet up the body and up into the chest and then into the arms. And it has an urge to grab and do something aggressive. And the face wants to become and an angry expression. So that's the specific kind of somatic pathway of anger or rage. And this is across cultures and ages and everything. It's a physiology. It's just the way the body operates when these emotions are triggered. And as opposed to grief, everyone can mostly relate to grief. Sadness, you're thinking about who died or what was lost. You feel like crying. You feel, and you do cry and you feel that pain inside. So these are different physiologic experiences of feelings that are different than unconscious anxiety, which tends to blot away or distort those feelings. So as an example, if a person has quite strong irritable bowel symptoms, they get a conflict with their spouse. Next thing is they feel nauseated and they have diarrhea. But what happened to the feelings? You see, in the moments where the feelings were there, they weren't experienced. No, they weren't felt on a conscious level. They just disappeared into the stomach, okay? Now, obviously treatment involves being able to identify and feel these feelings. I guess that's what you're going to ask me next, isn't
it? That's where I'm going. It's like you read my mind.
So, you know, how to correct this thing here is to identify and feel the emotions that are activated. in any moment in time that are otherwise going to shunt into or turn into or activate symptoms. What we see is there's mixed feelings do it. This love and anger and then guilt about the anger, feeling remorse about the anger. That is the common thread across all of these patterns is unresolved guilty anger. Why do I say there's going to be guilty anger? It's because I've worked with some people who had no anger inside them that was unresolved. They only had some leftover sadness, no anger at all, just some grief. And those individuals, not one of them had any significant symptoms. None of them present with like psychophysiologic problems or none of those things. They were very fortunate. And one of them, for example, the father died when he was 13, and he just had grief about it. For other sort of unfortunately the balance of us, there's more emotions, and there's these mixed feelings there, and it's inhibited anger because of guilt and love, so mixed feelings, and the solution there is identify and feel those things, and once the feelings are felt, there's no need for the body to generate anxiety anymore. There's no need to get depressed about these anymore. There's no need to be self-critical or self-punishing about these feelings anymore.
Can this be influenced by the way that someone learns to process emotions during their childhood? Like if they're taught to power through or be a bit of a stuffer downer?
Yes, these patterns, how we handle emotions is pretty much learned in whoever we spend time with in childhood or whoever raises us. That's the typical. So we learn what to do when there are feelings in there. So we learn what other people do. And the other thing, just to distinguish something, is actions. The difference between an action and a feeling. So if I ask someone, how do you experience the anger? The person says, well, I yell. But that's an action. It's not actually a feeling. I say, what do you experience in your body before you yell? And the person says, I get all tense. I said, but that's anxiety in your body. But what feelings are in there, that make you tense? You see, so the thing is, there's a confusion out there about the difference between a feeling and an action and anxiety, okay? Those three things are, if you look at try to figure it out by watching TV and, it's a whole thing is not, it's not presented clearly. It's not really taught, frankly. And there's enough people have difficulty with it that it's not easy to transmit. So it's you're fortunate if a parent knows the difference between these three things, because then they can help you to be able to identify and process your own feelings.
So what is the process for someone who presents as an adult with symptoms and says, okay, I realize I'm not processing whatever feelings happen to be stuck in my body? How do I do that?
All right. So the treatment model, this is what I'm referring to, is based on, it's called Intensive Short-Term Dynamic Psychotherapy, ISTDP is a short for it. It's about 40, 50 years it's been developed, and it's taught all over the place now and practiced. And there's like over 50 research studies on it. And it outperforms, on average, cognitive behavioral therapy for chronic pain. So it's a fairly effective model. It's relatively short. Not in every case. It's not effective with every person, but on average, it does well. Now, the way this approach works is it's built all about the response that we would use the term patient, but client and the therapist have. It works on the interactional, what happens in the interaction. So here's the thing. So a client comes in, sits with me. I'm concerned. I want to know about them. I want to know their problems. Well, what kind of feelings is that going to stir up? Well, first, they appreciate it, right? They appreciate it. At the same time, all those attachment feelings from times in the past when they were hurt start to come up. So here's what happens. The person gets unconsciously anxious. They get tense. They might get nauseated. They might get confused. And that allows me to see what way their body response is to emotions. Then we have a work together to help identify those feelings that are making anxiety in the room as they're attaching to me. So it's a lot of here and now work on recognizing the feelings triggered by being attached to you, the therapist. And as soon as they feel that those feelings, immediately their mind goes to the childhood trauma. And it's just linked right there. So their mind immediately is going to times when they were hurt, where those bad things happened. Those memories and emotions come right forward as you attach to them. And I would say more broadly, this is a thing that happens with people. It's not just a therapist office thing. Attaching to a new person. These emotions are mobilized when you like somebody, when you're attaching to somebody. It's an opportunity of a new relationship does that, or even a current relationship that may not be that going that great. It's still an opportunity to sort out these old emotions that are getting triggered in the new relationship situation.
Do you recommend that this be conducted solely under the care of a professional, or is there any sort of, lighter version that you can share with people that they can do at home in a safe manner?
It depends on the person and who their support network is. But this, the back half of this book, okay, of the Hidden From View book, is built for, I'm going to say, it starts off, it's built for a beginner therapist or like a family doctor who wants to improve their interviewing skills. And then it blends into doing a kind of a light version of this treatment approach. So it's built into that back half of the book. You can understand, people can understand it when they read that. And you can apply elements of it on your own. You can help one another on it. I mean, this is these things we're talking about are human processes. They take place in all healing interactions. They take place when you meet your doctor. You know, so when you're saying earlier that what if you're worried your doctor will judge you, so you don't say anything. Well, that means there's some feelings about judgment coming up toward the doctor, mm-hmm. right? You know what I mean? Now, so going into the office, the person might get nauseated before they get in the office or their pain goes up on the way to the office. And they're saying, well, why is that happening? I'm there to get help. Well, it's an attachment and it brings up other attachment feelings. So anyway, like I say, it's just a normal thing across human relationships.
Yeah. What do you see happening in the next several years in terms of chronic pain treatment? Do you see this becoming more commonplace and mainstream?
I hope that there is an enhancement of self-guided, self-directed, and clinician-led, you know, first of all, education, meaning education of health professionals so they understand some of these things and can apply some of them. And then clinicians, and people who can deliver helpful therapeutic relationships that deal with emotions. And beyond that, more is, you know, pain management that links into these things, you know. So pain management programs that recognize these things are relevant and important and bring that in to the care models to try to improve their outcomes. This is a hope. I mean, the research tends to help move the needle a bit. Education can move it a bit. I think public pressure, when it comes down to it, is probably maybe more important. You know, people can influence the healthcare systems. People can change these things. It's almost more important than. You know, you can ask the doctors and you can ask them the medical school where you're at, do you teach about this thing, right? Or if you don't, why don't you teach about this? So it's, you know, people have power. I mean, I can tell you the people I've worked with somatic symptoms, they're extremely bright people. I mean, almost being bright is a risk factor in a way, I think. It's kind of like it's something to do with sensitivity and being a caring person that sets the stage for being hurt by others and causing emotions to get blocked up. So it goes a little bit with being a sensitive person, a caring person, and also a bright person. And what I mean by bright, I'm talking like, you know, sometimes like brilliant. Like, I mean, I'm trying to keep up here.
Yeah. And these same people are almost waiting for something to happen to them through a clinician sometimes, when they can really step up and take the power and say, hey, I want to know what you think about this. Can we incorporate this into my treatment? And something I found that I'm really interested in.
So yeah.
Everyone's got to remember that it starts with driving your own boat and then communicating more with your own clinician, encouraging them to share what's working for you with their other patients. And then, like you said, from there, you can branch out to the medical schools around you, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And so knowledge, you know, knowledge is power over these problems. It really is. You know, and the other thing just to say is a lot of these symptoms cause us to freeze up, you know, cause us to not move, to be frozen, okay, physically frozen. But you know what overcomes that is movement of any type. And I'm not just talking physical. I'm talking mental movement, planning, going, doing. It overrides body's fear to do something. You know, okay? So this is also probably why a lot of models of care help in some way because they unfreeze the person. So that's, you know, if I'm encouraging the listeners, it's recognize some of these things, the power you have, you know, that you can do things for, you know, you can press things and you can get yourself to be able to move within certain limits and break any fear cycles just by physically moving and doing some things, knowledge, educating yourself, educate your, you know, health professionals, go try to drive the plans the way you want this, you know, the plan for your care to be, you know, one thing I will say about medical education is there has been a move to increase the empowerment of the patient. That's something they've really been spending time teaching in the last 20 years. So the younger physicians, especially, they expect you to give them an idea. You know, I say, look, I think this is the thing I need to do. Or I need to, can you refer me to this? They'll appreciate it a lot of the time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think empowerment in your own health journey and just knowing that you can make a difference in the healthcare system is a beautiful message to send to all of our listeners and to end on. So thank you so much for joining us today, Alan. I know that a lot of folks are going to feel very empowered by this episode and be learning more about the connection between their symptoms and their anxiety pathways and having some important conversations with their own healthcare providers.
That's great. Well, thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for listening to Like Mind, Like Body. If you or someone you know is experiencing chronic pain or other chronic symptoms, be sure to check out all of the tools and resources that are available to you right now at curablehealth.com. And if you are interested in reading more about Alan's work, you can purchase the book that he co-authored with Dr. Howard Schubner. It is called Hidden from View, A Clinician's Guide to Psychophysiologic Disorders. That's all for today. We'll see you here next time. Bye-bye.